Oyez, oyez, oyez. All persons having business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this Honorable Court. Be seated, please. Case number 09-3140, United States of America versus Deonte Marshall, appellant. Mr. Smith for appellant, Mr. Press for appellee.
Good morning.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Greg Smith and I represent the appellant, Deonte Marshall. Mr. Marshall's conviction should be reversed for three reasons. First, the guilty verdict was the result of coercion on multiple levels. Second, Mr. Marshall's conviction was obtained after speedy trial violations. And third, Mr. Marshall, his trial counsel was ineffective in failing to present his speedy trial arguments below. First, on coercion. The law is that jurors can't be coerced to surrender their views conscientiously held. The trial court's intent to coerce is irrelevant. Even undesigned coercion requires reversal.
Is it your judgment that's your strongest argument, the coercion argument? I mean, you're starting with it first. I presume that's what you mean.
Your Honor, I rarely have a case with, just speaking candidly here, with two issues as good as I believe have here. I think the speedy trial issue is extremely strong here, and I think the coercion issue is also strong.
I'm interested in the ineffective assistance argument, so maybe if you could help me with that a little bit. The standard for ineffective assistance, we look to Strickland here, right? If we assume that there was prejudice from a mistake, tell me why you think this mistake was unreasonable. There was no case law on 404B at the time. Why would it be ineffective assistance for his counsel?
Well, Your Honor, I think
to get that one differently.
Anyone reading the decision that Judge Rogers and you were involved in, I don't think could possibly come to the
majority opinion says specifically we don't take up 404B, right?
It does, but the dissent clearly states that that should be the rule and that it naturally flows from the 609 decision.
The dissent, right. So do we hold our attorneys to that standard, that they need to be arguing what dissents say? If they don't, they're acting unreasonably?
I guess
as persuasive as the reasoning was in that dissent.
Well, I think the reasoning not only was persuasive, but what perhaps distinguishes it further was your own decision saying that the dissent may well be right. And I think in that circumstance, any reasonable, competent counsel reading that decision, the Van Smith decision, I just don't know how a competent counsel reads that decision issued 1 month before the indictment in this case and doesn't come to the conclusion that at a minimum, it needs to be raised. And what's particularly troubling here, Judge Griffith, is that the case is ultimately cited.
It's ultimately what?
The case is ultimately cited in a supplemental brief that's filed by substitute counsel way later in June. It's cited in a footnote, but clearly the attorney that cites that case doesn't understand what it's saying. And I'm explicitly saying, there's broad discussion, not just in the dissent, but also in the majority opinion about the implications of this. And I understand the court, Your Honor, did not take up the 404B issue, but the dissent clearly said it naturally flowed, and the majority, Your Honor's decision, didn't deny that. It simply said we don't.
Is it? I guess what I'm struggling with is whether it's ineffective assistance not to raise that argument persuasively. Let me sort of double down on you. How about is it plain error for the court not to have picked up on it? I mean, the court thought that 404B told the statute. Is that plain error?
Your Honor, I think you certainly can come to that conclusion, yes. Particularly when
now the standard for plain error is very high.
I understand. And I don't think the plain error standard applies here because the defendant himself did raise the issue below
He didn't raise the 404B issue. And in fact, he argued just the opposite.
Your Honor.
He argued just the opposite, right?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I think if you look at the colloquy from this defendant, he specifically says, my lawyer didn't raise any motions until December.
No, but the theory, the Speedy Trial Act theory that you're making now was not made in the district court.
It was not.
Was it?
I think it was raised, perhaps not as artfully as it might have been raised, by the client himself. He was allowed to speak freely.
What about the prosecutor's statement? Didn't the prosecutor alert the district court to the issue?
That's right. The prosecutor also said the law in this issue is not clearly in my favor. And I think particularly in that circumstance, when it is highlighted for the judge that the reliance is not justified, for the court to never even look at it or address it, and frankly for nobody except I guess the prosecution knew and didn't follow up, I don't think.
Well, the prosecutor said there's some dispute.
That's correct.
And the district court said, I've been holding this way for 7 years and I'm sticking with it. And
that's right.
The end of the district court's discussion.
That's correct. And though Van Smith had just come down, and even though Van Smith had changed the law in 609 undeniably, which
let's not say change the law.
Well, excuse me, had clarified the law. And in fact,
the whole point was Harris had been out there for some time.
Right.
All right. And the theory and rationale of Harris, at least I thought, applied to 404B.
Right.
So given that the district court was alerted by the prosecutor, is this a case where it's a plain error review or not?
Your Honor, I don't think you need to rely on plain error. I think there is plain error, but when the defendant himself is essentially making the very issue, which is there were no motions filed by the defense until December. There were no real motions.
That's an argument about delay, isn't it? I thought that was the implication of Judge Tatel's question to you. He's not raising the 404, what the government style is a motion. It's not a motion, it's just a notice.
That's right.
So that wasn't raised by the defendant, but it was raised by the prosecutor.
Well, it was raised by the prosecutor, but I do think the defendant also, when he made the comment, essentially, there had been no motions filed in this case until December, was in essence saying the 404B notice that was filed wasn't a motion.
I understand your point.
Let me ask you a question about the ineffective assistance claim. I notice in your brief that you ask us to remand to the district court on that issue, right? Yes?
I did. It may not be necessary.
Well, that was my question. Why would we? Why did you ask for that? What would the district court do?
Well, I think the district court would find ineffectiveness.
No, but we. We remand to the district court usually if we think there's some factual finding that needs to be done, like determining whether the lawyer's behavior was, you know, legitimately strategic or something, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
What would we remand? In fact, you know, in your answer to one of our questions, you made a very strong argument that this was just flat-out ineffective assistance of counsel, that he should have argued it and didn't. Why would we remand?
Your Honor, I raise that only because as I understood it, was the normal procedure in this circuit.
No, our normal procedure is we remand if the issue isn't clear one way or the other.
Okay. I think the issue could not be more clear. Judge Griffith, answering your question,
So in other words, if we sent this back, you would say to the district court, you have no factual findings to make at all? Can you think of any that you would want?
None that are apparent to me, Your Honor.
Okay.
You know, I just can't fathom how a defense lawyer reads Van Smith and doesn't see that this is an issue that at a minimum needs to be raised. I just don't. And that's sort of the bottom line. And let me just add, you know, I think that the underpinning of Judge Rogers' dissent and Judge Griffith, yours as well on 609 is absolutely important and important for this court to extend. I have not practiced most of my career in this district. I practiced in another district, and we didn't have these placeholder kind of motions that were put in place, and the Speedy Trial Act meant something. Now, I'm not here to tell you that there were times, I mean, There are complex cases, particularly in this district, and there are times when you need speedy trial extensions, and it's a...
There's nothing particularly complex about this case, you're saying?
No, well, it's not
440
just...
440 days after indictments, kind of hard to understand on a single count.
Agreed. But even more than that, Your Honor, eliminating these placeholder, this notion of placeholder motions, can, you know, government just files something and we forget it and everybody forgets about the Speedy Trial Act. That's the way things seem to work in this district, and that's not what Congress intended. The Speedy Trial Act was passed to give meaning to speedy trial. It was passed out of frustration that the constitutional speedy trial guarantee had not been adequately fulfilled. If you look at the legislative history, that's what it was all about. And as long as this court sanctions government notices essentially being motions, and then as here, you know, this motion was, so-called motion was filed in October, there's a motions hearing scheduled in January, and the government never bothers to tell the court, oh, we have a motion too that needs, you know, let's resolve it in January. There's no discussion about that, and the reason there's no discussion about that is because it was nothing, it was a placeholder. In fact, it's expressly discussed as a placeholder. But I guess what I'm telling the court is, from a salutary perspective going forward, this decision, if you reverse and find that 404B motions are, in fact, just as 609 motions, are notices and nothing more, you will give meaning in this district to the Speedy Trial Act.
I hear what you're saying. The procedural problem you have for yourself, or you have here, is that probably the only way we can get to that is either through plain error or ineffective assistance of counsel, right? I mean, assuming we don't accept your argument that it was properly raised. That's the problem here.
Well, I think the ineffectiveness could not be more plain.
Yeah.
And particularly when it's cited.
So do you think which of those do you, assume for a minute that I didn't think it was properly raised. Do you think that which argument is, Do you truly think is stronger? Is it that it's plain error or that it's ineffective assistance of counsel? Which one do you think is your best argument?
Judge, I think it's ineffective, but I also think that when it's brought to the court's attention that there should have been some exploration. I mean,
the advocate, you can say they're equally strong.
Candidly, Your Honor, this is a wealth of riches I rarely have at this podium. This is a case that I was just telling my wife, it's as good an appeal as
hard to know where to start, right?
Why don't you save the rest of your time and let's hear from the government.
Thank you.
May it please the court. Good morning. Stephen Prest for the United States of America, the appellee. This court should affirm a...
Why isn't this just flat-out ineffective assistance of counsel?
Your Honor, for two reasons. Mm-hmm. First, counsel's performance here is not clearly deficient.
Well, is there any principal distinction at all between a notice under 609 and a 404B notice?
There is, I would
what is the What is the distinction?
Well, certainly the purpose of Rule 609 notices are to provide the defense with an understanding in advance of trial that should the defendant testify, the government will seek to include and impeach the defendant.
What's the purpose of a 404B notice?
The purpose of the 404B notice, actually, in this case a motion, is to allow the government to not only put the defendant on notice that the government intends to introduce evidence of the defendant's other crimes or bad acts, but also to, as here, seek a pretrial ruling on the admissibility of such evidence. Here, counsel could not have been constitutionally deficient in performance because, as the court points out, the government, although not specifically one to raise the issue as whether Van Smith and Harris applies in the 404B context, did in some way alert the counsel, as Judge Rogers indicated, to some dispute in the law. So counsel was already put on notice that this had occurred. Counsel, for a second reason, cites to Van Smith in, as appellant counsel indicates, the
this
supplemental
for this
motion.
Point?
Pardon?
Arguing this point?
No, Your Honor, not at all.
What's the value of citing to it, then?
It's, well, because the government also filed a notice.
I mean, it seems to me you're strengthening the argument that there was ineffective assistance of counsel.
The defense filed or made reference to Van Smith with respect to Rule 609 because the government also filed a Rule 609 notice here. I would argue that that is evidence that defense counsel at the trial level was both aware of Van Smith and also making a tactical decision to actually...
So you think we should remand for a determination whether it was tactical?
I would argue that that's not necessary because the second prong of Strickland ineffectiveness is prejudice. And here, appellant simply has not shown the prejudice that Strickland envisions.
Really?
Yes, Your Honor. Strickland envisions prejudice that would come from an unfair trial.
Yeah, but if the argument had been made and the district court had changed its mind, wouldn't it have dismissed the indictment?
But, Your Honor, the dismissal under the Speedy Trial Act is either with or without prejudice. Appellant has never asserted at any point during any of these proceedings that the dismissal should have been for prejudice. So at best, he would have been entitled to dismissal with prejudice, or without prejudice, rather. Under those circumstances, the government simply would have presumably reindicted the case and tried the defendant on the same charge at a later point in time.
Well,
so any sort of...
We don't know that, do we? How long has he been in prison?
Well, it had, as I believe Judge Griffith pointed out, it was 440 days from indictment to the trial.
And? So how long has he been in prison as of today?
I couldn't presume to do the math, but I guess the indictment was July 22, 2008. We're now in 2011.
So he's been in prison for over 3 years.
Yes, Your Honor, after conviction. Yeah. There is simply no evidence of Strickland prejudice because the only prejudice appellant alleges in this case is that because his attorney did not file a motion to dismiss on speedy trial grounds, for which there was no controlling authority in this district and may not necessarily have even been granted, intervening Supreme Court case law changed the posture of his trial. He does not assert that he was denied a fair trial, simply that he was denied the right to have a trial under previously more beneficial Supreme Court case law, and that simply is not a basis to find unfair prejudice under Strickland.
So Strickland bars a finding of prejudice where the outcome would have been different? Almost quoting Strickland.
You are, Your Honor, and where the outcome would have been different, yes, but the case law is clear post-Strickland that references specifically the right to a fair trial. Would the outcome have been different because the defendant was denied some right or... Exactly, Your Honor, yes.
Right. Effective assistance of counsel.
But here he was not denied an effective...
You're arguing it's strategic that counsel waives a potentially meritful motion. But I don't understand. What's your best case on your argument that Strickland is confined to fair trial and results are irrelevant?
It unfortunately is not cited in the government's brief, but it would be Lockhart versus Fretwell, Your Honor, which does stand for the position that Strickland prejudice relates to the ability of a defendant or the right of a defendant to have a fair trial.
And that's the Supreme Court?
It is, Your Honor, from, I believe, 1992.
All right. And so if I read that, I will find that the Supreme Court has said, contrary to our statement in Strickland, we are now limiting prejudice.
I wouldn't argue that it's contrary to Strickland, simply that it further illuminates the court's definition of prejudice in Strickland.
Let me ask you two questions about ineffective assistance. As I read your one is on prejudice. As I read your brief, your argument about prejudice is that the district court, this has been the district court's rulings policy for years, and he wouldn't have, there's no indication he would have changed his mind.
Right? It is, I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Where in your brief did you argue your point about dismissal with or without prejudice?
It isn't specifically discussed more fully, but sentence.
Wait, it isn't specifically discussed more fully?
Well, the government's position
was...
Where
do you make the argument?
The government's
Could you
position.
Show me where
certainly
in the brief you make the argument?
On page 43, at the bottom of the government's brief, Your Honor, the government asserts that appellant has not presented any case law that would arguably make a showing of prejudice by any sort of deficiency the defense counsel makes. Uh-huh. Because the record refutes any claim that appellant's counsel was deficient or that appellant was prejudiced by any such deficiency, this court should deny his request
to remand this case. But where do you make the argument that that the lack of prejudice here, the absence of prejudice, comes from the fact that he didn't show that the dismissal would have been with prejudice?
Well, Your Honor, that specific argument, again, is not contained in the government's brief.
Okay. My second question is, it goes back to this question of remand. Suppose we thought that there was ineffective assistance. Both Strickland prongs were met here. I ask you the same question I asked defense counsel, which is, why would we remand that?
If the court believed that a showing had been made, a remand would be necessary at the very least to allow the government to present evidence that trial counsel's decision to forego an argument under the Speedy Trial Act in favor of pursuing the information needed to file a motion to suppress what appellant here claims is the government's best evidence, the defendant's confession, was in fact a strategic tactical decision that would have actually benefited his client greater, because it would have precluded that evidence from any future trial, regardless of the speedy trial issue. Furthermore, the district court did not plainly err in denying appellant's motion to dismiss on speedy trial grounds. As the court has noted, there was no controlling.
By the way, did you make that specific argument in your brief?
That there was no plain error?
No. I'm sorry. I'm taking back to the other one. That there was potentially a strategic decision here.
It was. Mm-hmm. Court's indulgence.
Just remind me, what exactly did you say in the brief about? I mean, the defendant seeks remand. Did you respond to that at all? I'm just curious. I don't have the brief here.
No, Your Honor. Okay. The government's position was that the record conclusively shows
there was just no ineffective assistance.
Yes.
Well, you didn't get to that. Okay, that's a fair point.
Yes.
Yeah.
And with respect to the court's ruling in denying appellant's motion to dismiss on speedy trial grounds, the district court did not plainly err because, as the court has noted, there was no controlling authority with respect to 404B notices or motions in the jurisdiction. While, as appellant claims, the defendant himself made some comments about his speedy trial rights. However, they did not, again, specifically address the 404B issue, and they never.
The prosecutor's comments.
The prosecutor
says to the district court, "Your Honor, there's some dispute about this."
The prosecutor.
So that puts the issue to the district court. Do you not agree?
The prosecutor did acknowledge that there was some dispute in the law, presumably referencing Your Honor's dissenting opinion in Van Smith and the majority's indication that possibly.
And presumably talking of Harris as well.
Correct, in the 609 context. However.
The rationale of that opinion.
Yes, Your Honor. However, the district court's attention was never directed to Van Smith or to Harris.
Well, when the district court's response is, "I've been ruling this way for 7 years. And I'm going to continue to do so." I mean, he has made a decision on the merits of the issue that the prosecutor has alerted the district court to, has he not?
I would argue that the district court's comment that he has been ruling this way for 7 years is not necessarily a meritorious finding, but rather just a comment of his practice. He approached then and inquired of defense counsel what defense counsel's position would be, and at that point, defense counsel simply said, "I agree, a 404B motion does toll the clock." So the issue itself was never properly teed up for the district court judge to make a ruling as to whether Harris and Van Smith would apply in a 404B context.
The trial counsel did his very best to try to get the judge to focus on the Speedy Trial Act and deal with these issues, and the district court would have none of it. I mean, what more, other than a written piece of paper going into the argument in greater depth, would the district court? The district court is not blindsided, neither is opposing counsel.
No, Your Honor, but again here, I don't think that the record shows that the issue was ever truly properly presented to the court as appellant now presents it on appeal. What was presented to the district court was some dispute, again, of the case law, which was not controlling in the jurisdiction, which, while certainly was a lens by which the court could view the application of the Speedy Trial Act to Rule 404B filings, did not specifically address those filings. And indeed, throughout the proceedings, both of appellant's trial counsels who raised the issue specifically in written filings to the court conceded that the 404B filing that the government made did in fact toll the clock. And so the district court had no reason to go behind that and address the issue any further. Moreover, even if this court were to find that Harris and Van Smith were somehow controlling, the government would argue that this case and the facts of this case are distinguishable from both those in Harris and Van Smith. With respect to the specific filing that the government made here on the 404B evidence.
I know, I was looking at that. Why do you think it's any different than the motion that was, motion in quotes, that was filed in the Van Smith case?
Well, as the...
Have you compared the two motions?
I have. I would argue that what is not important is...
That's a yes or no.
No, Your Honor. But I would argue that what is important is what this court's opinion in Van Smith discusses about the filing, because that is the guidance that is provided to the district court in making a determination as to whether, even persuasively, the facts in Van Smith are the same as the facts in this case. And in Van Smith, the issue was, yes, a pleading that was styled as a motion in which the district court clearly did not treat the filing as a motion, indeed ignoring it for almost 20 months and only addressing it at trial when it became relevant because the defendant chose to testify.
Here, the argument is the speedy trial time has expired and the judge has never addressed the motion. Indeed, the motion hearing is set sometime in the future, and this motion is not even mentioned.
This motion actually it was mentioned, and the court did set a briefing schedule with respect to this motion, although the court did acknowledge that it ordinarily took care of these motions on the eve of trial.
Precisely.
It did on...
Yes.
On March...
I've been ruling this way for 7 years. Here's how I rule in this court. We do this just before trial.
Yeah, and yet, the government requested relief in its motion, even going to the extent of providing a written order, a proposed order for the court to use, and the court, understanding the government to be requesting an evidentiary ruling pretrial, granted pretrial argument opportunity to be heard on this specific issue. I see that my time has expired. If the court has no further questions, I would ask the court to affirm.
Any other point you wanted to make, given our questions to appellate counsel?
No, Your Honor, other than the third issue with respect to coercion, the government.
You rely on your brief?
Yes.
All right, thank you. Counsel for appellant?
I believe that looking at the 404B motion in context, it's a notice. It doesn't specify the evidence the government is planning to introduce. It talks about that it asks the court to permit the introduction of prior misconduct in generic terms, and then describes the conduct. The specific evidence that they plan to introduce at trial is not put before the court in this so-called motion. It's a notice.
What's your
609?
What's your response to government counsel's argument that there may well have been a strategic decision here that has to be explored in the district court?
You know, I can't imagine any strategic interest in doing that in this case.
Would we have to, can we say that, or do we have to, doesn't the district court have to look into that? Doesn't that require some testimony?
Your Honor, I don't have an answer to that. It may. I think that, but I just particularly, I guess my answer to that is this.
Give me your best argument.
Okay, my best argument
why it couldn't possibly be strategic.
My best argument is this. The client specifically said, I'm willing to give up everything. Motions, everything. All I care about is speedy trial. He specifically said that. And when a client says that, he's saying, this is the most important issue to me. I can't imagine why you don't pursue the speedy trial argument and to do it as vigorously and effectively as you can. It was not done effectively here. It's a clear, I mean, they're adding up the days wrong, Your Honor. I just don't know how that can be a strategic call. I do want to address one thing raised by the government, and that is this notion that there was no prejudice here under the ineffectiveness claim. The government's argument apparently is that the ultimate outcome, I guess, of guilt or innocence is the standard. That is not the standard. The standard is whether it would have been a different outcome, not an ultimate outcome. There's no question here the outcome would have been different. It would have been dismissed. Under Section 3162, dismissal is mandatory for a Speedy Trial Act violation. The government says it would have ultimately been the same outcome. Well, that assumes so many things. It takes so many leaps. It assumes the court, when it entered its dismissal, would have entered it without prejudice. We don't know that. It assumes the grand jury would have reindicted. We don't know that. It assumes that the case would have been slow in getting to the trial, that it wouldn't have been reindicted and proceeded to trial quickly before June when the law changed and the government suddenly said, we intend to use the confession after all. None of that is known. If the lawyer had been competent in raising the speedy trial issue, they would have gotten a dismissal. They would have argued for a dismissal with prejudice. And probably if it had ever come back, the court would have been darn sure that it got to trial quickly, well in advance of June. So there's no reason to think, none, that if competent counsel had sought a speedy trial, that this confession, the most important piece of evidence against my client, ever would have come in. That is prejudice.
All right. Thank you. We'll take the case under advisement. You were appointed by the court, and we express our appreciation to you for your assistance.